Welcome back again to BadQuaker.com podcast. Today is podcast number 72 for Tuesday, December 27th, 2011. Today, we're going to have a series of audio articles, and between some of the audio articles, we're going to have some music by the band Grenades. Grenades is the band that you just heard a moment ago as the intro started. They were kind enough to lend us the intro and exit music for this podcast, and so I'm going to stuff a couple of their entire songs between articles, and so you get a chance to listen to them. Now, if you've seen the picture over at BadQuaker.com of me, you know I'm old. So this is not necessarily my type of music, but I know that there are a lot of BadQuaker.com listeners out there that are not old. So I'm sure this will have a greater appeal to those young listeners. For all of us old farts like me, you can just fast forward through the rock and roll music. Okay, folks, so we're going to take a ride off with some Bad Quaker articles and some original music by Grenades. And for all the IP Nazis out there that are trying to look for something to sue somebody over, I have full permission to use this. So, yeah. Thanks, folks. State, Society, and Government by Ben Stone. As has been noted by others, people have a tendency to confuse society and or government with the state. In discussions of freedom, this is a point of confusion that often ends in a person proclaiming something idiotic like, "You want to abolish all laws," or "You believe in a fantasy world where everyone is good," or the laughable, "Who's going to save you when the criminals break down your door and there's no cops to call?" For now, let's set aside the obvious retort, "When seconds matter, the police are 8 to 12 minutes away." Or my favorite, "If someone's breaking down my door, I'll only need the cops for body removal and insurance forms." The state. The state is an entity made up of a collection of individuals who utilize force, theft, and fraud in an attempt to maintain a monopoly of violence within a geographic boundary or national border. Individuals functioning as the state glean their income using what Franz Oppenheimer called the political means, as opposed to people who use the free market in what Oppenheimer called the economic means. Another way of saying this is to refer to the tax feeders and the taxpayers. There are variations within these groups, such as those who provide real services that the state has usurped, teachers, firefighters, police, courts, and other government positions that we'll cover later in the essay. Additionally, there are those who are parasitic to both the state and the taxpayer, but again, that's for a different essay. At this point, let's just focus on the state as the collection of individuals using methods that, under any other circumstances, would be considered criminal in order to expand or maintain their monopoly of violence and income. Society. Society is the set of individuals with common bonds who develop and set norms of behavior within their group. For example, in some societies, it's considered ill-mannered to eat with your left hand. Now, at this point, such restrictions wouldn't be called laws, but guidelines or standards of behavior. To violate them will bring consequences, but without the state, those consequences are limited. So then a person who eats with the wrong hand, for our example, may not be invited to dine with others, or may be considered backward, or not trusted, or dirty, and they may be shunned. Perhaps a shopkeeper wouldn't want them in his place of business, or a potential mate could refuse to wed this backward savage. Having had our vision so fogged by living under a state, we often fail to understand how much power rests in the hands of society and how powerful a tool shunning can be. When taken to its logical conclusion, those who refuse to conform to society are generally exiled from that society. Yet, in that exile also comes freedom from that society. The left-hander, in our example, can simply seek people more tolerant or intelligent. When the state invades the function of society, an ugly manifestation occurs. simple behavioral guidelines become regulations, and then, when they fail, laws. So the uncouth diner goes from first being ticketed and fined to eventually charged with crimes against the state and his left arm chopped off. You may say my example is extreme or unrealistic. Then consider the evolution of drunk driving laws in America. At first, if caught drunk driving, you could expect to be escorted home or taken to the police station to sleep it off. As long as you hadn't done any harm or damage, your behavior was simply frowned upon. Now, you can be stopped for absolutely no reason other than to see if you have been drinking. You can be tested for alcohol, and you can be arrested even if you don't show the slightest sign of impairment. You can actually be convicted for refusing to be tested, and under the right circumstances and for repeat offenses, you can actually be imprisoned even though you may never have caused any damages or any harm to any person or their property. All kinds of arguments can be made about keeping the roads safe or what have you, but none of these arguments can escape the glaring fact that you can be arrested, fined, punished, imprisoned, and if you resist, killed for a crime where no person or property were harmed. Additionally, people who had nothing to do with your, quote, crime will be robbed, taxed, at the point of a gun to pay for this, quote, enforcement, whether you agree with it or not. A free society has an abundance of tools to deal with harmful or unacceptable behavior, but the state only has one. The iron fist is the answer to every question asked of the state. Just for giggles, consider the coming terror of our age, texting while driving, the drunk driver of tomorrow. What will be the eventual reaction of the state when people continue to text? Government. It has often been said that the government which governs the least governs the best. By govern, I use the old definition of the term, to keep things normal or steady while providing the basic security. I don't categorically disagree with this statement, as far as it's intended to go, but I find it lacking in several areas. For example, if you've been harmed by a thief to the extent of the loss of $100 and you entrust your government to provide justice and remedy the harm, a government that only recovers $20 may be governing the least, yet surely lacking in its role of bringing justice. Or let's say an invading army marches across your land, burns 80% of your farm, and consumes 80% of your stored goods. You would hardly be satisfied with a minimalist government that only protected you by a margin of 20%, now would you? So let's talk about what we should expect from a government. A government should, first and foremost, protect us from foreign aggressors. If a government fails at this task, it hardly matters what other task it may be able to accomplish. Of course, we must define a foreign aggressor before we can check our government's performance. The word foreign could mean strange, but when used in this context, it's better defined as an aggressor from a different geographical area or a society. Likewise, a government must be able to protect us from domestic aggressors, those near us and within our society. So protection of the individual and the individual's property should be the highest priority of government. Protection from aggressors goes hand in hand with dispute resolution and justice. If government is charged with protecting individuals and their property, then government must have a means of determining who the aggressor is and what must be done to bring justice. Time has proven that government serves efficiently in the capacity of standardized weights and measures. Businesses can and have done this on their own, on a local scale, but government has the advantage of being able to make agreements with other governments, thereby providing a larger market for business than would otherwise exist. Governments must somehow be funded, otherwise it's incapable of hiring individuals to accomplish the tasks required of it. Lastly, governments must be subject to some form of governance. In other words, if individuals need a government for the reasons listed above, and that government is made up of individuals, then by its very nature, government needs governance, because it is simply a collection of individuals. Throughout the ages, mankind has experimented with a variety of models of government with a wide range of results. Many, but not all of those experiments, ended up with the government being supplanted by the state, and eventually a failure of the state causing a failure of the government, and usually that society. The most notable examples of these failures are easy to spot because of one of the great characteristics of the state, namely state propaganda, or, as it's better known, written history. Most of us know about governments that were supplanted by the state and later collapsed. We could name a few here, such as ancient Egypt, Persia, Greece, and Rome, or we could point to Central America and pre-Columbian times. But lacking the propaganda of the state, few of us think about stateless governments that lasted many thousands of years longer among the Gaelic, Celtic, Germanic, and other so-called barbarians across northern and eastern Europe, the steppes, and even Australia and sub-Saharan Africa and North America. Without a state, many people managed successful governments that protected and nurtured rich societies, bringing us from squatting under trees and rock overhangings through the Stone Age and almost to the modern age. The majority of medieval Europe, including some large cities and many towns and villages, remain stateless or virtually stateless for most of their history, and some areas were able to limit the encroachment of the state right up to the beginning of the 20th century. Medieval Europe wasn't exactly a libertarian utopia, but at its worst, large groups of people lived with no tax burden at all, and if some local duke or prince became oppressive, the average person could simply pack up their wagons and move to the freer town, a city or a region. Try that today, without the permission of the state. Try packing up your belongings in Rybnik, Poland, and hiking across the valley over the hills to Ostrava in the Czech Republic. Or better yet, try moving your family from Juarez, Mexico to El Paso, Texas, without the blessings of the state. The governments of the American colonies, as documented by Murray Rothbard in his masterful work Conceived in Liberty, were largely stateless, up until after the French and Indian War, when England attempted to pay its bloated war debt by robbing the wealth of the colonists. Even then, the son of an immigrant Ulster Scot, having lived his entire life in Appalachia, could grow a field of corn, harvest it, turn it into whiskey, barrel it, transport it to a city, and sell it, or trade it, without paying one penny of tax or asking the permission of one bureaucrat. Much of Appalachia was stateless and governed by its clans from the 1660s well into the 1800s, with its own distinct culture, laws, courts, roads, and contracts, while surrounded by what could only be considered hostiles to its west as well as its south and its east. Twice, invading armies attempted to move through Appalachia and were soundly rebuffed by voluntary militia. One of those times, when Appalachia was spontaneously united to stop British forces under Patrick Ferguson by soundly defeating and killing him at the Battle of King's Mountain, the false history of which is a perfect example of how the state lies to justify itself. The other time was the Whiskey Rebellion, an event equally lied about by the state, when some 500 Appalachians put the tax man in his place. Washington wisely avoided the mountain folk and their militia while parading his forces up and down the low country and proclaiming victory, a tactic he perfected during the War of Independence. Staying out of Appalachia hill country at that time may have been the single smartest thing Washington did in his entire life. Having said all of the above on the topic of government, I would like to point out three things. One, none of the above precludes more than one government functioning in the same geographical region as long as that government is not polluted by a state. 2. None of the above requires a government to initiate force on an individual or any other government as long as that government is not polluted by the state. 3. None of the above prevents an individual's involvement with a government from being on a strictly voluntary basis if that government is not polluted by a state. So then, we can see that a free society can have a government, and that government need not be in the clutches of the state. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. Grain-fed or free-range? I admit freely I'm a meat eater. Sure, I raise and eat vegetables, and I love fruits and nuts, but given a choice, I'll take a well-prepared steak over almost any other food. That's assuming that it's a good cut of meat. Here the terminology gets a bit fuzzy. Referring to a good cut of meat can mean simply the way the meat is cut and where the meat comes from on the animal, but it can also refer to the way the livestock was raised and what it was fed during its life. For example, grass-raised beef can be different from free-range beef, and either can be grain-finished or grass-finished. Additionally, the use of antibiotics and growth hormones should be considered when discussing quality meats. Some beef suppliers now use hormone implants, and I don't even want to think about what that will mean 30 years from now. Sometimes the simple act of learning the livestock handling and slaughter practices of the industry is enough to cause a person to give up meat entirely. My point in bringing it up is to demonstrate the attitude of one beef consumer. There are a lot of times that I buy beef from the store and I don't take into consideration what it was fed prior to its slaughter. Oftentimes, I may find myself ordering a steak or even a burger from a restaurant without thinking for a moment about the issue. However, if money and convenience were not a consideration and I were afforded the luxury of choice, I would prefer eating beef that was raised without weird additives in its diet or injected into its body. I would prefer eating beef that had spent its life belly deep in a variety of grasses and then processed in the cleanest facility by caring people. And I would venture to say most beef consumers would agree with me. Interestingly enough, the state feels differently about its livestock. Every indication I can detect points to the conclusion that the state wants its livestock grain-fed and drugged into a stupor from cradle to grave. And just to clarify, when I say that the state wants its livestock drugged, I'm referring to the kind of drugs that keep the livestock docile and working, not the kind of drugs that make the livestock happy or overly relaxed. Of course, the state doesn't actually eat its livestock. It utilizes them as beasts of burden. So perhaps if I didn't eat beef and only used it for raw labor, I might prefer my livestock pumped full of drugs and corn-fed as well. No doubt you think you figured out where I'm going with this topic. You think I'm going to make the argument that the state considers its subjects to be its livestock. Or perhaps you think I'm going to talk about how the state controls its subjects by pushing some drugs and forbidding others. Actually, I assume, if you're reading this, you already understand those to be the case. What I'm going to focus on is how the state treats its livestock, and to demonstrate this, I want to talk about how the state got its start and how it grew. As with many topics concerning the state, it's handy to look at the grandfather of the state, ancient Jericho, the oldest known city-state. There are older settlements in many locations, but Jericho is unique in more than one sense. A simple settlement or even an early town is a far cry from having that magical evilness required to spark the birth of the state. Jericho had a collection of perfect ingredients that not only sparked that evil, it nurtured it along for thousands of years before any other state appeared, and then kept the state alive when it died everywhere else. Jericho was located on a rocky outcropping in a huge, fertile valley of the Jordan River. For thousands of years, the climate was mild and the Jordan Valley was well watered. From the most rustic walled structure and with the use of hit-and-run cavalry tactics, a relatively small mob of thieves could hold the entire valley and all its farming inhabitants in fear. Additionally, Jericho's location was critical in controlling one of the mountain passes to the west, which separated the Fertile Crescent from the Mediterranean Sea. Having then a secure fortification, a steady income from extortion gleaned from travelers on the road, and a local supply of crops, Jericho only needed one more thing to become a state: working livestock. You see, a state cannot exist without slaves. It's interesting to note that it was roughly 3,000 years after its birth in Jericho before the state began popping up in other regions. For 3,000 years, the same advances in technology were happening in other areas, perhaps even faster, as mankind leapt from the Neolithic Age into the Bronze Age, but without the presence of the state. Around the time Jericho went from a robber's roost to a proto-state, a notable change took place in the way the Jordan River Valley was farmed. Fig orchards and goat herders gave way to the overproduction of grain. Rather than a field supporting 20 goats and a small family of 10, the same field could support 20 goats and 100 people. Of course, it didn't take 100 workers to farm one field. One small family per field was still plenty of labor. So began the blessing and the curse of Jericho. The thieves grew rich in grain, but they needed an entire economy to steal from if they were to have the freeloading life they wanted. They needed raw labor to build more fortifications, skilled craftsmen to produce goods for trade, and armed forces to collect the taxes and escort goods to new markets. But how could a few thieves hold such an organization together? They needed something at least as magical as the new farming innovation. They needed to somehow tie the legitimacy of the state to the surge in prosperity that grain farming had produced, and they needed to convince the growing population to obey and not simply turn on them and kill them. A deal had to be struck, and a myth had to be created. A formula was found that would satisfy both the thieves on the mound of Jericho and the farm owners. A deal was cut, and a lie was told, and the landowners would be in on the scam. The landowners could enjoy a life of leisure, and slaves captured from the stateless people in other valleys would replace their labor. And to hold the whole scheme in place, a god was usurped. A nomadic, wandering shepherd god named Damuzid had been popular with the tribal people for thousands of years. Carved figures of him were scattered throughout the caves and hilltops. So the landowners of the valley claimed to be descendants of Damuzid, and the thieves of Jericho became his priests. The shepherd god became a god of food and vegetation, and eventually the god of grain, and then bread. As was the case with many of the gods of antiquity, the name changed over time and distance along with the particular qualities of the deity. But the formula stayed the same as a number of later city-states adopted this myth of Damuzid as their original founder. As time passed, the scam worked in Ur and then Babylon, at the mouth of the Nile, and even faraway Kashi on the banks of the Ganges. The Greek half-god Heracles, or Hercules as we call him, was a later version of the same myth, as he was a popular source of legitimacy for reigning Peloponnesian families. So the landowners base the legitimacy of their land titles on the story that they are descendants of the god or half-god. The former thieves are now the priests, and they live in the fortification, now called a temple, where sacrifices and tributes are given. With the gods on their side, armies rode out of their fortress and began raiding the tribal population of other valleys, bringing them back to work the fields and serve the needs of the infant state. It's likely that working the farms of the state wasn't much worse than working any other farm at the time, so there would have been little reason to risk running away. Also, it's likely that when the armies of the state raided an area, they captured whole families and simply transplanted them. This was the method observed among developing states in Southeast Asia at and prior to the start of the colonial period. For their own safety, the landowners moved within the walls of the city, while most of the slaves were kept out. If the slave population weakened or the state needed to expand, it simply invaded its neighbors and took more slaves, then expanded to new valleys. So we see that the earliest version of the state was born when the deified thieves in their fortified mound united with the landowners, private business, and began using the overproduction of grain to feed their growing slave populations. Slaves not only worked the fields, they cut and stacked the rocks to build the city walls and towers that protected the elites. Whether by the use of rice, wheat, barley, or corn, the state monopolized food production and made its livestock dependent upon the daily bread. This happened in conjunction with the occupation and control of the valleys and plains through the walled cities and sweeping cavalry strikes against any uprising. The independent hill people, on the other hand, were not so easy to corral. They had food production methods that didn't include the overproduction of grains. While some grain was in their diet, they relied on root and leaf vegetables, tree crops, and nomadic animal herding. They didn't need fortifications because their leaders didn't rely on coercion. For defense against the state, the hill people relied on direct hand-to-hand combat methods and keenly developed artillery weapons like the sling and the dart. Cavalry was near useless in the hill country, and rows of infantry couldn't maintain their ranks as rocks and projectiles rained down from every direction. In the case of Jericho, the state could control the valleys and the trade routes, but not the hills and the mountains. Now we see why it was both symbolic and necessary for the biblical Joshua and his Israelites to crush Jericho before establishing their anarchical mountainous society that stood 500 years as a testimony of individual liberty and freedom. We see also why the anarchical Israelites carried few shields or spears and used no chariots. They relied on lightly armed individual skirmishers wielding sickle swords and slingers whizzing baseball-sized rocks at their enemy with deadly accuracy. With time, the state discovered that enticing new slaves with bread was more profitable than capturing them at the point of a lance. Cities began to draw new slaves in faster than the state could find work for them. That's when the state was presented with the problem of too many citizen slaves. And this happens each time the state begins to reach a phase of maturity. But the state has discovered two methods of solving this glut of livestock. Engage in war with another state, or divide your livestock into groups and encourage infighting until you can justifiably round up and murder a minority group. Sometimes both methods are employed, but the result is the same. The gears of the slaughterhouse turn and the livestock die. Like I said earlier, sometimes the simple act of learning the livestock handling and slaughter practices is enough to turn your stomach and change your view of the whole process. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. drug prohibition. Recently, Robert Higgs was at the Francisco Marroquin University in Guatemala receiving an honorary doctoral degree in the social sciences for his amazing contributions to the field. While there, he wrote this article, link provided on badquaker.com, about the drug war and its effects in Guatemala. It's a nice little article that caused me to remember that the effects of this prohibition and its associated black market are not just a plague on the people of the U.S., but an illness that hits the poor and the weaker countries far harder than most people realize. And without noticing it, this black market sucks a phenomenal amount of wealth out of the economy of the U.S. and into the pockets of criminals that use it to dominate small local economies in third world countries. In pondering this, it dawned on me that I haven't written an article specifically about prohibitions and their results. In one sense, I feel that explaining the negative effects of a prohibition should be unnecessary, since the very concept of a prohibition is based on the immoral position that one person, or a group of people, can rightfully tell another person, or a group of people, what they can and can't buy or sell. The idea should be repugnant to any civilized society. But sometimes I forget that a major portion of my fellow humans just move with the herd and never consider the morality of the individual aspects of the world that they sludge through. Easily enough, I could be like that. I don't use any forbidden substances or have any dealings with them, so I could just look away. Many good people around the world look the other way as their governments take their taxes and use the money to pervert true law and distort the market. For this reason, it's hard to approach people using a purely moral argument. It's an odd thing, really. People will agree with you if you say that immoral actions cannot produce moral results. Two wrongs don't make a right. We all know this and try to teach it to our children. But when we apply this moral standard to illegal drugs, somehow the same person who just agreed with you will stand on the argument that using aggressive violence on innocent people will cause other people to stop using drugs. It's remarkably counter-logical, and yet they cling to it with a level of blind faith any palm reader would drool over. And the funny part is that they will refuse to think about the fact that they are advancing an immoral act for a moral benefit. They are so deeply invested in the immoral solution that they can't let go of it no matter the consequences. For this reason, we on the moral side of the argument are forced to try to appeal to the practical desires of the delusional drug warrior. We attempt to explain how prohibitions have never worked at any time in history. We try to show them that the result of a government prohibition is always a black market where criminal elements of society always take over and reap huge profits. We try to explain how criminal gangs always dominate black markets and use the funding from forbidden products to fund their other criminal activity. We try to show that government prohibitions drive the price of a product up, making it more profitable to produce in higher quantities, therefore resulting in even more availability and more users of the product. We try to use facts to show that the harder the government cracks down on prohibition, distribution, and consumption of anything, all they ever do is make it more profitable for criminals. We try to show how each dollar invested in the enforcement of a prohibition only causes more vigorous black market with higher profits for criminals. But the drug warrior will simply fall back on a slogan or a myth, put their blindfold back on, and continue grazing. I remember vividly the spring of 1979 when I was 17 years old. Well, actually, I remember parts of the spring of 1979 vividly. Some of it is fuzzy. But I do remember one day in a city park with five friends. We had 2 6-packs of beer and had found a somewhat private area where we were just sitting, talking, and enjoying the California sun. Up walked 2 policemen who began their little song and dance routine for us. We remained respectful as they lectured us about breaking the law with our evil beer. When they finished their dim-witted lecture on being good citizens, they opened each can of beer and poured it on the ground. One of my friends thanked them for, quote, giving us a break, and they humbly acknowledged that they were indeed cool cops, and it was a good thing some other cops didn't find us first. I looked one of the cops in the eye and asked him if he actually thought that would keep us from getting more beer. He didn't answer. He just stared at me angrily that I wasn't groveling at his feet adoring his coolness. But I was incapable of respecting someone who openly stole from me under the guise of law. I had worked in the hot desert sun for minimum wage to buy that beer, to have some costumed thief take it from me and pour it on the ground. So we hopped in my 66 Mustang and zipped down to the grocery store, where my friends created a bit of a distraction while I stole a case of beer and a bottle of Jack Daniels. Then, that night, I slipped down to the police station on foot with my wire cutters and clipped some antennae off of the parked police cars. That's what you call a net loss of tax expenditures. In my mind, I could clearly see the immorality of the police in their enforcement of a stupid prohibition and the guilt of the shopkeeper in supporting this thuggery through taxes and through voting for the mayor who appointed the police chief who instructed the cops. I viewed my actions as just retribution for my loss and humiliation. My logic and my ethics may have needed some adjustment, but the basis of my anger was just. As a partial result of this experience, I quit my job and spent the next few years making a very lucrative income, skirting the law, and using black markets to my advantage. So you can trust me when I say prohibitions take a small problem and create huge problems. Once again, Bastiat is proven correct when he asserted that there are seen results of government actions and there are unseen consequences. And generally, if these seen results are good, the unseen consequences are bad. And if the seen result is temporary, the unseen consequences are long-term. So the moral argument aside, prohibitions simply don't work. In 1979, powder cocaine was only slightly harder to get than marijuana. Meth was widely available in pharmaceutical quality, and crack, or as we called it on the West Coast, rock cocaine, was everywhere and cheap. However, I only knew a couple people that had anything to do with rock or meth because of its potency and the dangers involved in using it. Then in the 1980s, a couple of popular movies and a popular TV show about Miami police focused on the cocaine market and glamorized it beyond reality. The public became alarmed, and politicians' typical knee-jerk reaction was to come down on the cocaine market. The result drove the price of the product up and made it more advantageous to the black market to sell it in its concentrated form, crack. So the potency of each dose was dramatically increased, creating more desperate addicts. In turn, the public panicked over the increase in violence and crime related to crack cocaine, so the prohibitionists' reaction was to focus on busting the crack houses. As crack users became more violent, police raids got more and more violent, creating the need to militarize small local police forces. As the prohibition on crack cocaine became a profitable industry for police trainers and equipment suppliers, the cold efficiency of the police raids caused another shift in the black market. Crack cocaine became less popular, and by about 1999, cheap bathtub meth became a competitive player in the market. So, within 20 years, government interference in the illicit drug market drove the consumer to prefer a much more dangerous and much more potent drug. Rather than stepping back, examining the lessons learned, and solving the drug problem, prohibitionists chose to press on with this idiotic, violent path. Mom-and-pop meth producers were targeted by law enforcement, and the morons in Washington, D.C. decided to punish everyone with allergies or a head cold by making over-the-counter cold medications harder or impossible to get. So, with this new wave of prohibition and vastly energized and militarized push to crush the drug market, every drug user in North America suddenly stopped using drugs, right? Of course not. The now super-rich gangs and cartels that had been rolling in cash for 25 years simply shifted meth production away from the mom-and-pop suppliers and made an offshore industry. There are now drug cartels with individuals richer than the entire country that they reside in. The logical end of the story can fall in either of two directions. The individual people in the rich industrialized nations can wake up to the obvious and demand the state get its big, fat, ugly, wart-covered nose out of the business of prohibitions, or this problem will balloon out of control and threaten civilization itself. If you consider how many people the government has imprisoned for drugs and drug crimes in America, how many are currently imprisoned and how many have been through that meat grinder and have been released onto the streets, a staggering percentage of our population has become hardened criminals due directly to this prohibition. At present rate, the, quote, war on drugs is creating an army of dangerous, angry criminals that will someday reach a saturation point, and there will be no turning back. We will make the French Revolution and the Russian Revolution look like mild footnotes in the chronicles of history if this thing is not stopped. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. Wisdom of the 8-Hour Day by Ben Stone. What I have to say in this article could easily be misunderstood and could bring offense to people I would never want to offend. For that reason, I ask the reader to be kind to this old man and indulge me with some leniency before you reject me as a senile old fart. At the age of 19, and through an odd series of circumstances, I landed a job working in a chemical factory. I worked day-to-day with old men, many at or above the age of 60, who had spent the majority of their adult life right there in that factory. I took great pleasure in sitting with these old gentlemen, listening to them talk. I would nudge them and with questions about their lives and about their outlook on things, and at all times and all subjects, I would allow them to express themselves without the slightest contradiction on my part. At the time, I believed these old gentlemen were endowed by their years with wisdom, and if I could drag it out of them, the lessons I could learn would give me an advantage as I walked on my path in life. However, after having worked there 8 years, I came to the conclusion that most of those old men in that chemical plant were simply fools and not in the least acquainted with wisdom. After all, they spent their life working in that hellhole. How wise could they be? So I quit, and I changed career paths. Much like my father before me, I moved from place to place and from this job to that, dragging my family from state to state. Over the course of years, I worked farm labor, I ran a black market business, I delivered pizzas, framed houses, shoveled quicklime and tunnels, managed restaurants, worked in a lab, owned two construction companies, sold and installed window coverings, built custom computers and networks, and worked on a variety of projects for the Department of Defense and NASA before landing a dream job in the development engineering division of a major aircraft engine manufacturer. In January of 2003, I worked my last 8-hour day of my last 5-day week. My body had given its all to earning a living for my family and myself, and it simply could go no further. I won't bore you with the various stages of mourning and denial and boredom and frustration and anger and acceptance of a physical disability in this writing. Rather, I would like to tell you about a discovery I made after I had time to sit back and reflect upon my adventures. I never stopped seeking wisdom when I left that wretched chemical plant. With each job and with each new location, I kept an eye peeled for individuals who stood out from the herd, thinkers, but not just smart people with their heads packed full of facts. I watched for people who could think beyond what they had been taught, and I found a few, but only a few. And they weren't necessarily the people you would expect. In a laboratory packed with chemists and engineers, I found an atheist repairman with deep, consistent morals and convictions. I bumped into a musician gifted with wisdom beyond his years. And among brilliant aerospace engineers, I found a self-proclaimed neck-downer that possessed thoughts inconceivable to those around him. In my retirement, as I pondered all that I had learned and filtered it through the luxury of hindsight, I saw the secret, hidden from me for years, while plainly in front of me the whole time. Have I stirred your interest? I hope I have, and I hope I don't let you down when I reveal this obvious truth. You see, the 8-hour day, 5-day week, and the routine that supports it floods and starves the brain with dopamine, rewarding the most boring behavior while punishing the brain for free-formed thoughts. Our daily routine teaches us not to think. We wake up in an entirely unnatural manner that mimics an emergency. We frantically rush around the house in a half daze, never fully alert, then climb into our motorized coffins and join the driving brain dead for the morning commute. Over the course of the typical 8-hour workday, the average American job utilizes very little thought. Employers consistently seek methods and gadgets that remove the opportunity for employees to think or make decisions. As they do so, employees find less and less mental stimulation and become poorer in decision-making skills. All the while, the clock ticks and anticipation builds for that magic moment when it's time to climb back into the wheeled coffin and sit in traffic. The worker arrives home to a house where each member of the family has gone through a variation of the same daily brain-draining dopamine bath. I could go on to talk about how we sadly attempt to fill our weekends and vacations with stimulation and entertainment that simply distracts us from our pain and our boredom, like methadone distracts the addict. But you get my point. This whole routine acts to destroy the body while stupefying the mind until the day we turn a magic retirement age, physically useless and half-witted, awaiting death. This is why it's almost impossible to awaken the mindless herds to their own enslavement. The whole system is designed to keep us from thinking straight, and the longer you're in the 8-hour system, the less likely you will be to think freely and accept new thoughts and new ideas. Wow, that's some gloomy crap right there. I bet you're thinking right now, thanks, Ben. How about you cheer me up some more with a picture of a dead puppy? Well, I can do better than that. I can tell you what to do to keep this from happening to you. Get out of debt. Start with your smallest credit card or other type of debt and do everything you need to do to get it paid off as fast as possible. Eat mashed potato sandwiches twice a week if you have to. Cut your lifestyle down to the bone and pay off your debt. Pay off the smallest bill first and then put all that money that you're paying on that bill to pay off the next smallest bill. This may take years, but stick to it like your life depends on it, because it does. Debt is the biggest reason people stay chained to a job they hate. If you break the chains of debt, you take the first step to the freedom of owning yourself again. Once debt-free, you can begin to look at the 8-hour day job not as a necessity, but simply as an obstacle to overcome. Once free of the 8-hour, 5-day cycle, a period of detox will occur. Anywhere from a few months to over a year may be required before your brain will begin to function normally as it was designed. Eventually, you'll start to notice things around you that you never saw before. Like a muscle that hasn't been used, your brain will slowly start to learn how to learn again. But be warned, some things will lose their appeal. Things like televisions, newspapers may not shine as bright once your brain starts functioning. As for reaching out to those trapped in that system and its mind-numbing cycles, great patience is required to reach them. Once a person stays chained to this process and slides past a certain point, they will be hard, if not impossible, to reach. They won't be able to think clear enough to ponder the basic principles of liberty and freedom. At some point during middle age, having learned nothing genuinely new for 20 to 30 years, the mind will circle its intellectual wagons, draw out its weapons, and fiercely defend its blissful ignorance. For more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. more articles and podcasts on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, as always, go to badquaker.com. And thank you for listening. Thanks, folks. Goodbye.